Parsons, Stephen Boyd, and Aubrey McGee.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 15655, State v. DeLeon. Arguing for the petitioner, William H. Jamison, Jr. Arguing for the respondent, Sonia P. McCullen. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Jamison and Ms. McCullen. You're both ready to proceed today? Very well. We'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go, Mr. Jamison, so you can reserve that time for rebuttal, and we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes, Ms. McCullen. Please proceed.
Once again, good morning. William Jamison on behalf of the defendant.
If you could pull the mic down closer. Can be sure to hear you.
Defendant appellant petitioner Philip De Jesus De Leon. We are here, as we presented in our writ of certiorari, because we believe that the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred when the court affirmed the lower court's decision to exclude the criminal record and the specific acts of violence of the state's witnesses and decedent, I should say, the victim, Sean Powell, and state's witness. State's witness Jermaine Boudouin. I believe he says his name, Boudouin. Now, I'd like to start out by saying I'd like to separate the two because I think there are different issues involved. I think where the lower court went wrong with respect to Mr. Powell is by its reliance at the prosecution's suggestion that this case, with respect to the issue of whether or not there was a dispute as to who was the initial aggressor, this case was governed by the Louis case. And I can see how that might have misled the court, because on the surface it appears to be, at least on the surface. As you know, in Louis, the defendant there got into a fight with the decedent. The fight ended, but at some point the decedent told the defendant, "I want to blow your effing head off." Defendant went home, armed himself with a weapon, with a firearm, came back to the scene, was talking to a friend of his in a car, and noticed the decedent coming towards him. He disengaged his conversation and at that point started walking towards the decedent, shot him dead from 10 feet away. Sort of looks like my case, because what happens is there's a fight, people break up, and then client, Mr. DeLeon, comes back later and he ends up shooting Mr. Powell dead. But the cases are very, very different. Unlike the defendant in the Louis case, Mr. DeLeon tried to avoid what happened. He testified that he knew, based on what had happened, well, he believed what had happened previously about an hour before at the Bar 7, was that the group of people approaching him, which included Sean Powell and Jermaine Boudouin, were going to continue what had happened previously, namely, continue to beat him as they had started earlier at about an hour before.
Mr. Jamison, understanding that your point of error on appeal is whether or not there should have been allowed evidence of Mr. Powell's prior bad acts, but for you to say that Mr. Leon was trying to avoid it, couldn't he have just gotten in his car and left?
He testified about that. He said that after he had locked his car, he started on his way to the Soroball restaurant.
Right.
He heard, as he's walking, somebody say something about Mexican.
Right.
Excuse the language.
Yeah, and then he went back and got his gun from the trunk. Why didn't he just get back in his car and leave?
He thought about that. He said when he assessed the situation, actually what he thought about first, he said, was trying to get to Soroball. But on his assessment of the situation, that wasn't going to work. They were too close. He thought about getting back in the car, starting it up, driving away. But it was the same basic, his view of what he saw at that point in time. It wasn't going to happen. By the time he got the car started, they would have broken the window, pulled him out of the car, and just beat him like they did before. So that's why he didn't leave. It's not like he didn't want to leave. If you believe him, and that was for the jury to say, but if you believed him, he couldn't leave. He was put in the position where his The position he was put in was this: if I don't want to be beaten again for no reason other than the fact that I am a Mexican, I have to stand my ground. Because in the trunk of his car, there was a 9mm that he had bought, he testified previously, when his house had been burglarized. And he felt that under the circumstances, that was his only option. Again, that was for the jury to say. So that's why we can say this case is so different from Louis. Louis is nothing like that. Louis, if somebody tells you, they're going to blow your effing head off, and you go home and you get a gun and you see the person who said that, and the person is coming towards you, you already know that guy, you're provoking the situation because he wants to blow your effing head off.
What about the circuit court's observation that Mr. Powell had his hands up above his shoulders and was himself unarmed?
There was much more than that. It's true Mr. Powell had his hands up, but it was what he was saying at the time and what happened both before that happened and right up to the point of the shooting. At the point where Mr. Powell had his hands up, he had ignored several verbal, or at least two verbal warnings to stop, at least four warning shots to stop. He continued moving forward. That has to be an act of aggression.
Doesn't the video actually show him changing directions and moving towards Powell, moving towards the defendant?
Well, I think it's subject to interpretation. There's a smudge, and it's for the jury to say. I mean, it wasn't clear where you could look and say, oh, there's Mr. De Leon moving towards Powell. That's for the jury to say. Is it him or is it someone else? So that does not settle that. No, I don't believe that answers the question. But going back, Mr. Chief Justice, to your question, was he just standing there? Was this an act of surrender or an act of aggression? According to the state, it's an act of surrender. According to the court, it's standing there. And it's a little confusing because the court said, other than standing there, except that he was walking. So I'm a little confused on that. But what Mr. De Leon said is he kept on walking after the shots were fired, and he got close enough to where he, Mr. Powell, could have taken the gun away. But before that happened, he put his hands up like this and said, what? You think your gun won't stop all of us? That is not an act of surrender. That's an act of aggression. And that's where there's a dispute, right? I mean, that's where you got to wonder just who is the aggressor here. You know, if you want to understand both sides, I think the defense and the prosecution wanted to and did connect this case to Bar 7. But what the prosecution did, I think, which was, and I'll give them their due, effective. You know, they started this portraying Mr. De Leon as an aggressor from Bar 7 itself. If you recall, Mr. De Leon had testified that at Bar 7, he was the victim of an unprovoked attack by two people, two of whom was coming towards him, by the way, Mr. Baudouin and Mr. Powell. And it's interesting that all of the state's witnesses, Jermaine Baudouin, Lane Akiona, Justin Gamboa, and even Joe Chang, they're at Bar 7, and they all don't see Mr. Powell doing what Mr. De Leon said Mr. Powell did to him, which is just pulling forward and choking him because he apparently was a, I'm sorry to say this, a fucking Mexican. So I think the state, from the beginning, and by the way, let me say something else about that. The last state's witness about what happened in Bar 7 was Joe Chang. And what is interesting is when Joe Chang was through testifying, the defense said, we'd like the court to put him on notice. We want to bring him back. I'm going to put my client up there. He's going to lay a foundation that there's a dispute. The prosecution said, why do that? Why not do it now? We know what's coming. There's going to be a dispute. And so it's interesting what the prosecution does. First, he says, I'm going to object, though. Okay? And the court points out, yeah, there has to be a foundation. But the foundation the court talks about is Mr. De Leon has to know about the prior acts of violence. And then it's pointed out, we're not bringing it in for that reason. We're bringing it in for first aggressor. He doesn't have to know. But then the prosecutor withdraws his objection. You know, so the prosecutor, as I say, they know what's coming. And from the beginning, they set out to portray Mr. De Leon as the aggressor, starting from Bar 7. Mr. Baudouin, in particular, is an interesting part of this case. You would think that Mr. Baudouin would be easy to show he was the aggressor in Bar 7. Because after all, Joe Chang said that, he said to me, I want a false crack that, I don't want to say the word, effing Mexican. When Mr. Baudouin took the stand, he said, I never said that. And then Mr. Baudouin also try to minimize what happens in bar 7. Again, from the beginning, they're making it look like Mr. De Leon is the aggressor. Because Mr. De Leon says, Mr. Baudouin hit me for reasons I don't know. And then Mr. Baudouin said, well, because you swore at me. Mr. De Leon disputed that. He said, I did not do that. He never swore at Mr. Baudouin. And Mr. Baudouin went on to say, like, Mr. De Leon had to be escorted out. So from the beginning, the state is linking this to bar 7, and from the very beginning, making this look like Mr. De Leon is the aggressor. And from the beginning, we are disputing that. You know, with all due respect to the lower court, I had a hard time seeing how on this record the court could not find that there was a dispute as to who was the aggressor in this case.
Could I interrupt you at that point, Mr. Jameson, because you indicated that you were surprised to see the analysis that said where there's a bar fight that precedes this, where there's a threat that's a serious threat based on somebody's ethnicity, where there's a group of men that are approaching Mr. De Leon, where he fires the gun into the air, and still, if I understand the facts, there are people coming at him, right?
At least three.
All of those facts to the ICA were facts that did not qualify for evidence of first aggressor. Now, in trying to determine how that analysis proceeded, what do you perceive to be the standard that was applied? If we consider State versus Basque, the standard that was applied seems to be, loosely speaking, what you said. Is there a factual issue? Do we look at it a factual issue and apply abuse of discretion standard? Or, as I understand it, you're contending there was a constitutional right at stake here. So what kind of a standard should be applied by this court in determining what this means, that there is a factual dispute? Is it purely abuse of discretion, or should it be any evidence that would support the theory? How would you describe that?
I'm sticking my neck out. But first, I want to say, before I answer that question, can I say this? What I was confused about the ICA's ruling was they seemed to be saying that, okay, it doesn't come in. The record didn't come in. But it was harmless because Mr. Chang, Joe Chang, testified about 2007 assault on Mr. Chang by Mr. Powell. And also because Mr. De Leon was allowed to testify, and I take issue with the word allowed. I think he had to be given the right to testify about what happened at Bar 7. But I think the ICA is saying, look, the jury heard that Mr. Powell, how violent and aggressive, according to Mr. De Leon, he was that day.
Am I understanding you to say that you believe that the ICA would concede that this was an issue, that is, who was the first aggressor?
I don't know what the ICA was thinking. I was confused about their ruling.
Well, let's get back to this case then. At this level, your position is that it was error to exclude it because the issue of first aggressor was before the court. So how
I think
do you...
It was a factual finding that was clearly erroneous, is what I think. If you look at all the evidence that the court heard, consider what everybody said. The issue isn't who was the first aggressor. The issue is, does this record reflect that there's an issue as to who was the first aggressor?
Isn't that a 104, and it's a factual determination by a court, and the court only needs to find that there's sufficient evidence for a jury to make that conclusion?
I believe under 104, that's a 104 conditional relevance. You're right. And that's why I thought that condition had been met.
Yeah. And was there a jury instruction given for self-defense?
There was. You first.
If there was a jury instruction given as to self-defense, would that be an indication that there was a factual issue as to self-defense?
Well, the interesting thing is, you go back to Louis, yeah? In Louis, an instruction is given on self-defense.
Yes.
Okay. What is not given in Louis, what is given here, is the issue as to who is the first aggressor. Because in Louis, what made this case different from Louis, too, I'm glad you brought that up, is that in Louis, the prosecution did not raise the issue of first aggressor, didn't even ask for the instruction. In the Basque case, I think what the court said in Basque is one thing about Basque, they made it, in fact, Basque is an interesting case. What they say in Basque, I think, applies here. In Basque, they say, the prosecution cited Louis. Well, Louis is not similar, but we keep Louis for the rule. And that's my case, okay? My case is not similar to Louis, it's very different. But we keep the rule of Louis. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, I was leading to the asking you whether you think that where there is enough evidence support to support an instruction on self-defense and the self-defense theory is based on first aggressor, would that establish a sufficient basis upon which to allow evidence of prior convictions to show first aggressor?
Well, as much as it pains me to say so, not in and of itself. I think the court still gets to weigh what comes in. But certainly the giving of the instruction creates the necessity for the prior acts of violence, because now there will be an issue as to who is the aggressor, and the prior acts of violence would be circumstantial evidence that by character the decedent was the aggressor.
Well, the court does do a weighing when it comes to an instruction, correct? I mean, theoretically, a court could deny a request for a self-defense instruction where the court determined that no reasonable jury would find self-defense based on the evidence, right?
The court could have done that.
But where the court does give the instruction, and it's your position there needs to be further weighing by the court as to what evidence should be admitted as to the first aggressor issue when it comes to a prior conviction of the victim.
You know what I think? I think on the issue as to whether or not there has been sufficient evidence, whether there's been sufficient evidence to establish there's an issue of first aggressor, I have trouble saying that that's a question of discretion. To me, either right or you're wrong, like in this case. The evidence either shows that there is sufficient evidence of a dispute, or the evidence does not. Now, whether or not, once you get past that, you say, okay, there's sufficient evidence, well, what comes in is, I think, subject to weighing. But on the issue of whether or not there has been a sufficient showing of initial aggressor, I could be wrong, but to me it ought to be a right or wrong answer.
So it'd be right or wrong review? I think you said clearly erroneous before.
Oh, that's about the findings of fact.
Okay. Can I ask you about Mr. Beaudoin and the interesting question or a question I had about him is in Rule 404, A2 talks about character of the victim. Evidence of a pertinent trait of character of the victim of the crime offered by an accused can be admissible. Now, in this particular trial, this is a retrial. I believe Mr. Beaudoin, and correct me if I'm wrong, there had been a conviction of Mr. De Leon with regard to Mr. Beaudoin in the earlier trial, but in this case, there were no charges, if I understood, active involving Mr. Beaudoin. So, does the rule even contemplate allowing evidence of character of Mr. Beaudoin, who's basically a witness as opposed to the victim, as charged or as set up in this particular trial?
I tell you, Mrs. Chief Justice, I think I saw that one coming, because when I looked at the rule, you couldn't get in Mr. Beaudoin. Actually, I think his name is Beaudoin.
Yeah, I
think it's Beaudoin, I think.
Beaudoin.
Sorry. I think Mr. Beaudoin, what were they saying? Okay. I lost my train of thought.
I'm so sorry. But 404, is he a victim for the purposes of the rule allowing admission?
No. The problem with Mr. Beaudoin is you can't get in his character on the 404A2. He's not a victim. And you almost seem to have sort of a problem on the 404B, because 404B, its words are, plain language is not admissible to prove he acted in conformity therewith, and that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to prove Mr. Beaudoin was acting in conformity with his violent, aggressive conduct as proven by his criminal record and by his assault record convictions and the specific things he did in getting those convictions.
So why isn't he a victim? Why isn't he, I mean, if there was a reckless endangering and the defendant was convicted of conduct that endangered him, why isn't he a victim?
Well, I mean, he wasn't a victim in this case. He wasn't on trial.
But it's arbitrary or not whether or not he's in this case or he was in the first case. And I mean, are you arguing that the government could sever and by severing would be allowed to?
No, see, I was kind of taking a long time to get to where you are at. This is a victim, okay? Because, you know, like you look at the first trial, he was a victim in that trial, he's still here.
And okay? It's the defendant's perception, right? It's Mr. De Leon's perception. And it doesn't change whether it's the first trial or the second trial.
It does not change.
Whether or not he and Mr. Powell are being aggressive towards him.
Absolutely. And 404B, you know, I mean, you want to interpret it in a way so that, you know, we get to the truth. And so you avoid a miscarriage of justice. And there's this problematic language, but you could make a decent argument. He is a victim in a real, very real sense of the word. And therefore, maybe if it doesn't come in, if it's not exactly like 404A2, it's close enough, you know, to where the policies are the same. You know, I mean, this guy is claiming to be a victim.
Well, wasn't he a victim in the first trial?
He was. And even in this case, he's portraying himself as a victim.
Well, the facts are the same in both cases, right?
Hopefully, I mean,
if he weren't a victim, he'd be a witness then. I mean, he's still a player either way.
He's both. I mean, and the other thing, this is group aggression. This isn't just one guy, you know, I mean. But, yeah, he portrayed himself as a victim in this case. I mean, he said, if you recall his testimony, that he's coming back to the car and then he hears some yelling. And so he follows along with Mr. Powell to the source of the yelling. And when he gets close enough, he sees, oh, that's Mr. De Leon. And he recognizes De Leon, the person he had slapped earlier. So he says, oh, everything is cool. And all of a sudden, De Leon pulls out the gun and starts firing. If that's not a victim, what is?
Well, suppose he had shot at Mr. Powell and at the last second, Mr. Baudouin pushes him away and Baudouin gets shot. Does that mean Powell's convictions don't come in?
Well, so what you have a hypothetical again? So at the last minute, what happens?
Well, let's suppose you shoot at one person and you hit somebody else and they're both physically attacking you. Do you only get the conviction in of the person who's actually hit?
No. If they're both physically attacking, they both should come in because they're both the aggressors.
Right, but the evidence code talks about the word victim.
And maybe victim can be expanded to include a witness. You know, when the witness is an aggressor too.
Well, just because he has been convicted before doesn't make Mr. Guan less of a victim in this case, I guess.
Not the way he portrayed himself. So. Anyway, that again, with respect to Mr. Powell, as I said, the other issue I wanted to address was this. The ICA seemed to say, okay, on this record, we cannot say that the trial court abused its discretion. The reason I was confused with that statement is because when you talk about a trial court not abusing its discretion, generally, you see the court engage in a balancing process. You know, like in this case, for example, if Judge Garibaldi had said, okay, you know what, I think that there's a dispute here, and I think that we need to consider whether or not I'm going to let the record in, because after all, Mr. Powell's convictions were both 9 years old. They happened in June 13 of 2000. And then she goes through a weighing process and then says, okay, well, it's old, but I have to weigh against the fact, does he need it, you know, and so forth. And if you arrive at that conclusion after going through that process and said that the, I conclude that its probative value is outweighed by its prejudicial effect, this would be a much different case, but that never happens. It's like the ICA did the weighing.
What do you think about I think Mr. De Leon tried to get prior arrests of Mr. Goodwin in. Do you think that that's relevant? Not convictions. Well, convictions, but also arrests.
The specifics of the arrest.
Yeah.
I think the case law says that it can include that. It's subject to the court's discretion. You know, how good is that evidence? How long is it going to take? And how old are they? But, yeah, in my view, Mr. Boudouin's criminal record, especially that assault second where he is assaulting his girlfriend and then the lady who ends up with a broken jaw tries to stop it, and then he assaults her. I mean, It seems to be an unprovoked assault on her. What happened to Mr. De Leon over here? So I think, and the case law does say, you know, that, you know, under certain circumstances, it can come in. It's not excluded. Because I think that case, that interesting case where, I think it was the Bass case, it was really interesting, where the prosecutor tried to argue the only kind of way you can prove character is through reputation and opinion. And the court makes it clear, no, you can do it this way, too, specific acts or convictions.
Do you want to address the harmless error issue?
Assuming that's what the ICA meant when they said on this record. The reason I disagree that it is harmless is because look at what was allowed in, according to the ICA. Well, we have Mr. Powell testifying how he was assaulted by Mr. Chang, Joe Chang, saying that a couple of years before, my time is almost up. Well, this is why, because I think Chang minimized it to such a degree that whatever impact it may have shown the jury that Mr. Powell was a dangerous person was lessened, you know, he minimized it. He made it look like it was his fault. You know? And as far as what this idea that, well, Mr. De Leon, he was allowed to testify about how he was assaulted by Mr. Powell and Mr. Boudouin. Fine, except that he was the only guy saying that. Everybody else seemed to be contradicting what he had to say. So, to me, it's not harmless. It cannot be. To me, it could have made a difference in this case. It would have strengthened the argument, I did not start this. I did everything I did to try and end this. I didn't want to shoot anybody. But the fact is, you could make a strong argument. I was confronted with two racist, violent, aggressive people who wanted to finish up what they started earlier. And if you don't believe that, look at the kind of people they are. Look at the convictions. Look what Mr. De Baudouin in particular did when he assaulted that poor lady. Look at Mr. Powell. He's got these two assault convictions. Does he stop in 2007? No, he's assaulting Mr. Chang, who's doing his best to minimize it because Mr. Powell was his friend. So, no, I don't think that it was harmless error. I see my time is up. So.
Thank you, Mr. Jameson. Ms. McCullen.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Excluding evidence of victim Sean Powell's prior convictions complied with Hawaii precedent, State v. Louie, but more importantly, it complied with the Hawaii Rules of Evidence, Rule 405. And in the alternative, the exclusion was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Further, the exclusion of witness Jermaine Baudouin's prior convictions and arrest was proper because HRE Rules 404, 82, and 83 are inapplicable. And in the alternative, exclusion was also proper under HRE Rule 405. Excuse me. As for Powell's convictions, a key issue here is whether the evidence would have been admissible under 405. After deciding admissibility under Rule 404A2, the court must still turn to 405 to determine what form that evidence may take. Under 405A, 405A allows reputation and opinion evidence. Specific instances of conduct come in only during cross.
Ms. McCullen, can I ask you, I'm sorry I don't know this, the incidents of violence or assault that did come into evidence.
Yes.
Of Mr. Powell's two prior assaults on a prosecution witness, are those the same assaults that he has convictions for?
No, it's not. Those assaults happened maybe 2 to 3 years prior to the incident here. His convictions were 9 years prior.
Do you think that those prior convictions and the prior acts that were excluded by the trial judge, that pertain to violence being used by Mr. Powell are relevant to the question of who was the first aggressor?
It can't, yeah, it's relevant. It can be relevant.
Okay,
but it's still not admissible under 405.
Well, I'm interested in that, okay. How is it that you conclude if it's relevant that it's not admissible?
Well, according to the plain language of 404A2, the court determines, you know, the evidence can come in, but it depends on the first aggressor issue. And once that's
go ahead. So we've determined that the first aggressor is an issue. That evidence is relevant. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you were going to explain why it's still not admissible.
Let's say it is relevant in this case. And then the court needs to turn to 405 to determine how that evidence can come in. And according 405A, it has to be reputation or opinion testimony, and specific instances of conduct can only come in during cross.
Did you argue 405 in your answering brief? It's
no,
not cited.
No, I didn't, and okay, I apologize
so
for that.
So you're raising a new argument here today?
Well, this court, it's well settled that this court can affirm on other reasons that support affirmance.
So why don't if you can, summarize your argument that
405 doesn't allow for prior convictions, like in this case, to come in unless it's through cross-examination or if it's if the character of the witness is an essential element of the crime or defense.
Are you suggesting then that our Louis case was wrongly decided?
No, Louis came out in 1979. The HRE was enacted by our legislature in 1980. So at the time, Louis is correct.
But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but I mean, Basque applies Louis, yeah. And Maddox applies Louis.
Maddox.
And what those cases say is a defendant claims self-defense to charge of homicide is permitted to introduce evidence.
Maddox, Estrada,
they're all wrong.
Adam, they all relied on Louis. But they seem to have overlooked 405. And what happens now?
But I think there may be a reason, and that is because the court was applying the common law, which continues to be applicable.
Well, common law was what Louis applied in 1979. But then the legislature spoke in 1980 and enacted the rules of evidence, including, because it's a legislative enactment, and it included 405 in that enactment.
So no prior convictions are admissible to show first aggressor, no prior convictions of a victim, in your view?
Unless under 404A, it's during cross-examination, or 404B, character of the victim is an element, an essential element of the defense or crime.
So just so I'm clear, are you now abandoning the argument that the court got it right in terms of finding there was no factual dispute?
The state still believes that under Louis, the facts are very similar, and Louis was decided correctly at the time. Basically, the two cases, an armed man shot and killed an unarmed man. But should this court decide that there was a factual dispute and we get past 404A2, then we still need to turn to 405.
Can I ask you if this is wrong in Basque? It says the court abused its discretion when it flatly prohibited appellant from arguing to the jury or otherwise eliciting evidence of the criminal history of the deceased. And then we cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that such an abuse did not contribute to the jury's verdict. I mean, is that wrong? I mean, you're basically saying all those decisions are wrongly decided.
Well, I'm saying that they overlooked 405, and yes, maybe they need to be reconsidered.
That's quite a thing to say that all those justices on all those courts on all those decisions.
Was 405 argued in those decisions?
No, they weren't.
In Maddox, 405 was raised, but then the defendant waived the argument.
Yes.
But let me ask you about Mr. Boudouin and his actions. Isn't the ICA says in their opinion that the testimony was that Boudouin ran away before the shots, but wasn't he part of the group that was advancing on Mr. De Leon?
Just considering Mr. De Leon's testimony, one shot was fired and two ran away. The next set of three was shot and two ran away, and Mr. Powell was the last standing. So at some point he did run away.
How far was he away when, what did the coroner, somebody testify how far he was away from the gun?
I thought he couldn't opine as to that.
So, Mr. Powell?
No. Yeah, or I think he just said it was close.
6 inches, maybe?
6 to 7 inches.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah.
That's pretty close.
So back to 405. What happens now is that we have this situation where should the court or should defense satisfy 404A2 or the court decides that it's relevant under 404A2, if we apply 405 in this situation, the evidence wouldn't come in. The prior convictions wouldn't come in. But if we, and that's if we apply the plain language of 405. If we apply our case law, it would come in. And so we seem to have this conflicting situation where 405 conflicts with our case law. And that was recognized by Professor Bowman in his 1990 manual. It was also recognized by Professor Barkey in his 2017 handbook.
So you are asking us to address 405 now?
Yes.
And the reason that's argument, we shouldn't consider that argument waived, is what?
It's still part of the necessary analysis, I think, that the court should have applied. And I think it would help settle this conflict between the plain language of 405 and our case law. It would be helpful.
What about the issue regarding Mr. Beaudoin, whether he would be a victim for purposes of 404A2? Is the fact that he was, Mr. De Leon had been convicted of a reckless endangerment with regard to Mr. Beaudoin in the earlier trial, so now in this trial, does not actually include, if I understand correctly, the trial we're talking about here didn't actually have a charge related to Mr. Beaudoin. Can he nevertheless be a victim of the crime within the meaning of 404A2?
Well, I think if we look at the rule strictly, he wouldn't technically be a victim. If we do consider him a victim, it then goes to the 405 analysis, and I think it would be excluded under that. He's also
If we're looking at first aggressors, would he be a first aggressor? Assume he hadn't been, Mr. De Leon hadn't been convicted already of and recklessly endangering Mr. Boudouin. Is that what he was convicted of, reckless endangerment?
I can't see what call, sorry.
But would the fact, would he still be considered, would the court still have to consider whether he was a first aggressor?
I think as being part of a group, his actions would be relevant. But he is a witness in this case, so he may fall under 404A3. But then those rules, A3 references, apply to credibility, and any evidence of priors or specific acts would have to go to dishonesty and untruthfulness. So it would be excluded under that also.
Could I ask your view with respect to harmless error? You have mentioned that you think prior acts were relevant. And I know you're suggesting that they're not admissible under Rule 405, but assuming that we determine that the prior acts and the convictions as well are admissible with respect to Mr. Powell, what's your position as to whether or not that error would be harmless or not?
Yes, it would be harmless. There's no reasonable possibility that it might have contributed to defendant's reckless manslaughter conviction. The damaging potential of Powell's two prior convictions is to show the jury that Mr. Powell had an aggressive, violent character. But we were able to, the jury was able to see that through testimony that Mr. Powell was in a physical altercation with Ray Burgess, that Mr. Powell punched Joe Chang.
Oh, well, there's certainly evidence to support a jury verdict of guilt, no question about that. But is the standard that we would apply in making a determination whether there's harmless error, whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict? Is that the standard that we'd apply?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes, I mean, you're addressing the point that it seems as though there's ample evidence to show that Mr. De Leon was the first aggressor and Mr. Powell wasn't. And that's a standard that we would apply if we were determining whether there's sufficient evidence to support the verdict, right?
Well, there's ample evidence.
But the discussion we're having doesn't center on whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support a conviction. I'm asking you, in the event that we find that there has been error because these prior acts that show whether the first aggressor was Mr. Powell or not were not admitted. And if that is error, then we don't apply the same standard we would as to whether there's sufficient evidence to support a verdict, right?
Well,
there's a different standard.
There's cumulative evidence of Mr. Powell's.
Well, what would be the what is the standard that we apply when we determine that there has been error?
As to the 404A2?
Yeah, error in the sense of not allowing for the admission of evidence to the first aggressor. What would be the standard?
Oh, okay.
We have to find.
The case law says, right? The case law appears to say abuse of discretion. I disagree a little.
I'm glad you disagree because that's not the standard. We have to determine whether or not it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Well, I think as to the admitting or excluding the evidence under 404A2, that's more of a relevancy determination.
Sure, so and if once we determine normal. Once we determine there is error,
okay,
then we apply a standard.
So the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Once we determine there's error.
Is whether there's a reasonable possibility that the exclusion might have contributed to the conviction. And so in this case, I'm saying no, because there was cumulative error of Mr. Powell's aggressive nature or character.
Ms. McCollum, though, understanding that the two incidents that were testified to at trial were not the ones that he was convicted of, but the people who were victims in the offenses in which he was convicted, were those people involved in this case at all?
No, not that I could tell.
So can you see where the jury might see that people who were involved with him on that night would testify one way? Apparently there was a lot of Mr. Jameson's view is a little bit of coloration of testimony. Whereas if there's testimony of somebody completely unrelated to this case who he assaulted, that might be more interesting to the jury?
I can see where that, and Ray Burgess wasn't, I apologize, Ray Burgess wasn't part of the group, and there was testimony that came in that Powell had got into a physical altercation with him.
Okay.
So, yes, the state believes that it's overwhelming, too, or the evidence is overwhelming and compelling here to support reckless manslaughter. So in that sense, it's harmless also.
I wonder if that same argument was made on the first trial, that there was overwhelming evidence of the murder conviction. I don't know. I just wonder if that same argument may have been made.
I can't remember. Apologize.
So would you agree we'd have to overrule Bask to adopt the position you're advocating for here today? Because Bask seems to indicate that Louis was codified in the Rule 404A2 and imply that clear import is that specific instances of conduct would be admissible under that rule.
Yeah, I think we need to at least clear it up and understand how it interacts with 405, and I think they're actually conflicting. So to that extent, my answer would be yes.
Very well. Anything further for the court at this time?
No, in conclusion, the court, in conclusion, the state reiterates that Mr. Powell's prior convictions were properly excluded, same as Mr. Baudouin's. And thank you.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Jameson, any rebuttal?
Justice Powell, in answer to your question, I believe that the coroner testified that Mr. Powell could have been standing anywhere from 6 inches to 4 feet away. There was evidence of stippling, but it was on clothing, but you couldn't really tell if it was stippling 4 feet away. If it stood 6 inches.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to respond. I'm not criticizing that they bring a 405 at this point. That can happen, you know, even more surprised that you'd be asked to overrule BASC, because I think BASC expresses a lot of courts say across the country.
Mr. Jameson, didn't Mr. DeLeon say he meant to shoot him in the shoulder but shot him in the chest instead? I mean, with that, how can the testimony of recklessness not be overwhelming? Isn't it kind of reckless to aim a gun?
There's a lot of things happening.
Aim a gun at somebody, and I meant to shoot him in the shoulder but shot him in the chest. Then,
you know, I don't play golf, but, you know, one thing I do understand, it's one thing to make a shot from 6 inches away when you got nothing at stake, but when you have $1 million at stake, a lot of people miss. You know, when somebody is coming at you and you're firing all these shots and adrenaline is flowing and the guy is moving at you, and it keeps coming, and you don't want to shoot, but he's putting you in the position where you have to shoot, you could get off. You know, you can say what you want. It wasn't dead center. According to the coroner, it was, I think, below midline of the collarbone, above the nipple. But that's the shoulder.
I think Justice Nakayama's asking a different question.
What's the question?
Look, how is that not reckless? Isn't that overwhelming evidence of recklessness around, you got a full gun, you're shooting at somebody.
That somebody might take that gun away and use it on you. You don't have time to weigh, like, point per. You could, I suppose, if you were under different circumstances, say, maybe I better shoot him in the leg. Maybe I better try one more warning shot. Maybe I better shoot him in his hand. But you have to take into account what is happening at the time, the adrenaline flow, the fear. You know, there's not enough time to think clearly.
Wouldn't that evidence also go to self-defense? The jury may have found, in this case, if they found self-defense, they might have found a reckless. But there are two circumstances with reckless conduct that does not necessarily automatically restrict self-defense to a reckless offense.
I'm sorry. I mean, like.
Okay. In other words, the question is, would another jury also, because of where the bullet hit, have to reject self-defense entirely for the charged offense?
I don't think so, because they can look at all the circumstances. They can look at the circumstances under which the shot was fired. I mean, he missed. You know, but it wasn't like it wasn't anywhere in the area of the shoulder. They could say he missed. He simply missed because there was just too much going on. And besides, if I remember correctly, there was evidence of sort of a turn or something, because it was an angle, you know. Somebody can move at the last minute. If I'm aiming at you, and at the second you realize you might get shot, you could move. You know, I could be aiming at your shoulder. It's you who caused, in a sense, because of the way you move. You move into the shot. So I don't think the fact that he shoots him under those circumstances necessarily precludes another jury from saying that has to be reckless manslaughter. The shot could have ended where it was because the victim moved in such a way that he might have gotten shot in the shoulder if he hadn't moved at the last minute. So that's the way I would ask. Anyway, I'll just wrap it up. Time is up.
Anything, nothing further at this time, Mr. Jameson?
Not at this time, thank you.
Okay. Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys. The court will take this matter under advisement.
your time.